This meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you. This meeting is now being recorded. And we'll run from 9 to 12 today. If you don't have a copy of the agenda, we'll be sure that you receive one. Brian circulated them this morning, along with just a dozen or so slides. It's really a discussion opportunity and could not come at a better time. We're going to dispense with introductions of the long list of guests since the Adobe Connect faithfully records the names of all those who've joined in Adobe. However, this is a great opportunity for those of you who are not on Adobe to read your name out, those of you who are dialing in, for instance, and not on Adobe. So we would like to have a great appreciation for those who are present but not recorded in Adobe. So we'll start with this room here in Washington, D.C. Would any of you who are not in Adobe please give your name and affiliation? We'll start on the front row here.
Good morning. Susan Anthony, United States Patent and Trademark Office.
Turn it on, James.
Hit the green button to turn your mics on before you speak. Thank you.
Sorry, James Bladel from GoDaddy. Registrar. Thanks.
Justin Phillips, iCanWiki.
Matthew Rubin, ASAP Global.
Travis Johnson, IACC.
Timothy Chen with Domain Tools.
Debbie Cohn, International Trademark Association.
Steve Metallitz on behalf of the Coalition for Online Accountability.
Laureen Kathan, Federal Trade Commission.
Hiranga Kahangama, FBI.
Ashley Heineman, NTIA.
John Rodriguez, U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
Becky Burr, Newstar.
Jonathan Fenton Zook from ALAC.
Jim Prendergast, the Galway Strategy Group.
Margie Milan with Facebook.
Mauricio Vira, Perkins Coie.
Lori Schulman, International Trademark Association. Melinda Kern, Copyright Alliance.
Christina Metropolis, American Apparel and Footwear Association.
Sarah Deutsch, iCanBoard.
Phil Moreno, Winterfeld IP Group.
That's great. Thank you for the room in Washington, D.C. Those who were not on Adobe introduced themselves. Are there any others in Brussels or on the phone who would like to introduce yourselves because you're not in Adobe?
Jonathan Cohen, Intellectual Property Institute.
Here in Brussels, Claudia Felli, AT&T, BT.
And Jamie Patel with LVMH.
Martinucci with LVMH as well.
Paolo Garcia from Aetna.
Captain Balabouis, European Commission.
Philippe Pétillon and Alexander Herbeck from Pétillon Law Firm.
Jörg Köpke, German Federal Ministry of Interior, Public Safety, Berlin.
Any others? All right, great. Thank you very much. We're going to wrap up quickly with a brief setup, and then I'm going to turn over to Brian Winterfeld, who will walk through the agenda aspect of an overview of what we, I guess, have come to call the ICANN convergence model. And again, this is Steve DelBianco speaking, but I wanted to remind everyone about one important element of context. The ICANN interim model is not and was never proclaimed to be an ICANN bottom-up multi-stakeholder process. It is a top-down, unilateral decision by ICANN when faced with what they believe was a credible threat of legal liability for their who is policy and the requirement of that who is policy on contract parties in the face of the GDPR coming into effect in May. So ICANN does not seem to take well to critique that this process didn't use the multi-stakeholder model because that's not what it is. It's ICANN, legal and executive management team, doing a consultation with the community, and many of you have been part of those consultations. Some have been formal with public comment. Others have been done through meetings and seminars and webinars, like the one the BC and the IPC conducted on the 24th of January. So We're gratified to believe that some of that consultation has affected ICANN's selection of the model. But let's be clear, this is not the multi-stakeholder process. We'll do our best, though, to re-engage the multi-stakeholder process. But for the time being, what ICANN is doing is being sure that it is protected. That seems to be its first foremost goal. And the second goal is to try to accommodate the concerns of the users of WHOIS, as well as those who operate the system, registrars and registries. With respect to registrars and registries, we have many of them involved in today's webinar, and I'll be happy to have their specific input throughout the day, but I would summarize their top three priorities. The first is to ensure that whatever model that they adopt, let alone what ICANN does, that they will want to avoid to the greatest extent possible the liability, including fines, of being held in violation of GDPR. And we would all do the same thing were we in the shoes of a registrar and registry. In other words, regardless of ICANN's model, if ICANN's not indemnifying contract parties, the contract parties still have to be sure that they won't be in violation. Second is as a former programmer, I can tell you that I empathize this, but the registrars and registries want to treat legal and natural persons the same and not have to make some artificially intelligent distinction between the two. And I think we'll see that in the convergence model that's coming forth. And the third is this notion that it be globally applicable, and not just applicable to those that are resident in the European Union zone. So, again, something that would require a significant amount of artificial intelligence to determine whether somebody was subject to the GDPR or not. So those would be three contract party priorities. And the priorities for the IPC, DC, and other users of WHOIS for the purpose of protecting consumers and thwarting cybersecurity threats and protecting the brands that serve those consumers, the priorities are always to try to maintain as close to possible to the current WHOIS in a more accurate form than we have today, in a form that allows reverse WHOIS lookups. In other words, there's a whole panoply of ways in which we use it to protect consumers and stop cybersecurity threats that we've gone over many, many times before. But we will try today to do a gap analysis so it's clear where the missions we need to accomplish with the use of WHOIS, where they are met and not met by the convergence model. And then finally, I'll just conclude by reminding everyone that the process doesn't stop here. The community itself may replace whatever this interim model is by virtue of our power of developing consensus policies. In other words, there's PDP on the registration directory services, the RDS PDP, while stalled today, would potentially be restarted, reinvigorated, and with full attention at developing a bottom-up, community-driven process, because if one comes forward from the RDS PDP, it replaces the interim model. There is no doubt about that. It's in ICANN's declarations, and they've confirmed many times. The word interim in interim model is there because it's replaced by the community, should we act. And with that, I think I will turn it over to Brian Winterfelt to walk through the second element here on the agenda and an overview of ICANN's convergence model.
Thanks so much, Steve. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us here today about this important discussion. We are really happy that you all were able to join us. We put this together fairly quickly just because, frankly, everything's moving very quickly in the space, and we are working hard to stay up to date and keep you up to date with everything that's happening. Right now, ICANN has put forward what I believe they're calling the convergence model. It is sort of the latest proposal of what they are going to adopt as the interim model for compliance with GDPR. While Steve mentioned the community continues its work and is able to develop an alternative through the PDP, which we all know can take quite a bit of time. And so we're incredibly focused on making sure this interim model that gets selected is adequate and really is compliant with GDPR, but not over-compliant, and also really takes into account all the uses of WHOIS. That's really important to protect users of the Internet and to protect users of the various platforms and businesses that use the Internet. So I wanted to walk through the convergence model may really be new to people. It is actually not officially published, And that's something that I think has confused a lot of people. Even one of our speakers was looking for the published model. And so we're talking about a model that has not been published, but ICANN has gone out and has been speaking with community leaders to kind of walk through what the model looks like. So we thought it was important to take a couple minutes to talk about what we're kind of looking at today. ICANN previously put out three different models for proposals, and I guess it was sort of four because it was Model 1, Model 2 that had Version A and Version B, and Model 3. And so what they're saying is they've looked at the different community models that were put forward, they've looked at the comments and the feedback on their models that they've put out, and this is sort of what they're starting to hone in on. So I wanted to kind of just walk through briefly kind of the elements of that model because it may be new to some people who are joining us today. So there are still many questions and concerns that we have about the convergence model that's being put forward, and we are going to be talking in more detail about those, but I wanted to kind of cover those very briefly. The first is data collection. The convergence model will continue to mandate that registrars collect all FIC registration data. FIC data includes registrant, administrative, and technical contact information. This is something that we support. Data sharing, the model continues to mandate that registrars provide all collected FIC data to registry operator and data escrow providers. This is also something that we support. Data retention, the model currently stipulates the life of the registration plus 2 years. A full assessment of data retention obligations will ultimately be a matter for the Next Generation Registration Directory Services PDP working group because of the work involved in surveying legal requirements across the jurisdictions. We want to note that the GAC called for a 5-year period beyond the life of the registration, and WIPO actually suggested a 7-year period in their public comments. So we think that's an area where ICANN should consider whether they want to have a longer period of time, and we believe there would be legal support for that. The scope of territoriality, Fabrizio Vera, I believe, recently published a blog post on this topic that I think is very helpful with Circle ID. This is one of the major hot-button issues in the community. The model must be applied to all contracted parties and registrants within the European Economic Area, or the EEA. It may also be applied globally by individual registrars and registries, but only subject to a controller agreement that specifies additional implementation parameters. We are aware of potential problems with this approach with regard to over-application of the GDPR requirements for the sake of registrar expediency. So this is something that we're going to continue to talk about and something that we will talk about later today. Finally, this is something Steve noted also was the natural versus legal person scope, and the model makes no distinction between data of natural persons and legal persons. This was also something, again, that we think is going to be hugely debated, and it's something that that we do have concerns about, and there are obviously some implementation issues and challenges with figuring out the distinction between the two, but that's something that we will be talking about more and thinking about. There are kind of a number of other gaps as well, which I think we'll be exploring later today. There are public whois data elements that will be included. There's some discussion about what's not included. Right now, the model includes registrant organization, registrant state, province, and registrant country. So there are elements that are collected but will not be published that include the registrant name, street address, city, postal code, registrant email, registrant phone number, and administrative technical contact information. We believe that some of these elements may be things that could actually be included in the public data. An earlier version of the convergent model, for example, did include the city, at least that was gone over, but when it was reviewed with members of the intellectual property constituency, it was deleted. So we're thinking that there may be some changes there that might be helpful in the work that's done in the IP and security space and to assist law enforcement as well. So we may be looking at that and talking about what might need to be included.
I would add, Brian, that the the non-public who is fails to disclose the administrative or technical contact email address. But I believe in Model 2B, as published by ICANN roughly a month ago, those were part of the public who is element. So there's been movement, as you said, away from anything that ICANN had published to where what ICANN is now socializing. And they're socializing it with multiple groups over the period of the last 2 weeks. But over time, there have been modifications and tweaks in what they've been discussing. So we don't know for sure whether ICANN will announce its official conversion model today, tomorrow, or in the next few days. That's been forecast by CIRUS and the members of GDD. But there is still an opportunity to show that if the gap analysis reveals critical elements that we need, that this would be the time to make the best possible case for those critical elements to become part of the convergence model.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and that's part of why we're here today, is because the model is not published. ICANN has assured us they will not publish the model any earlier than next week. So we still have a chance to give our feedback and to push on these areas that we're going to be discussing today, where we feel like the model could be made stronger and be better. And you're right, there has been an evolution from what ICANN originally published, and there's even seems to have been an evolution, as we've noted, throughout the discussions with the community. And so I think it's really important from a BC and IPC perspective that we really push hard on the areas that we feel are able to be improved prior to the actual publication of the model next week, and really make that very clear to ICANN about not only what we would like to change with what's there, but also what we think is missing and really needs to be addressed. And this is sort of our last window of time. So, again, we really appreciate everyone joining today very quickly and becoming part of this conversation. And our hope is to go back to ICANN at the end of today, you know, with very strong feedback for them about how they can improve the model and what's missing and how it could be put back in. And our goal is to do that with justifications and support that we have from the EU Commission, from the GAC, from WIPO, and from our own work within the BC and the IPC to really show what the needs are of IP owners and businesses and security folks. So I think that is kind of a good quick overview of kind of where we're at. Oh, do you want to go over accreditation?
It's part of the convergence model overview.
Yes, but we're going to actually be going over that, I think, later today. Because I think just for time purposes, I want to kind of keep us on schedule. So I think that is kind of a brief overview. We did not cover every single point, but the points that we didn't cover in the overview are actually going to be discussed in more detail through our panels later today. But I would like to try and keep us on schedule. So I would suggest that we go ahead and move to our first panel, which is the latest updates on EU-level discussions. And so I'm going to be turning the presentation over to Catherine Bauer-Balst, Christian DeCuna, and Paolo Gracia, who have joined us today, and we're very grateful. And I would like to turn the presentation over to them now.
Yes. Hi, Brian. Hi, Steve. Hi, everyone. This is Catherine Bauer-Balst from the European Commission. Thank you very much for inviting me to present the European Commission of the Union position in public words. I hope you can all hear me. I have to start with a disclaimer, being a lawyer. Just like Christian from the EDPS will also have to tell you in a minute, we are not the regulators of the GDPR, so we can provide input and expertise, but it will ultimately be up to the national DPAs to take a judgment on whether something is data protection compliant or not. Now, that being said, I want to take you through just a couple of the main highlights of the comments that were submitted by the European Commission and by the European Union. So there was first a letter from three commissioners, and then you may have also seen the technical comments on the models, which build on one another. And I think the important messages can be summarized as follows, and I'm happy to enter into more details if there are specific questions. First of all, the Union does recognize the important role of the WHOIS and the very important role it has played for a number of users. And it tries to clarify in its position that the GDPR is not a step change. In fact, it just is a reiteration of a number of principles that have been around for a long time. And it's, the Union position sets out these main principles once again. I think one key message to take away from that is that the devil is in the details. So the data protection rules do not per se prohibit any form of processing as such, but rather they require you to think about why you are processing that data, to define clear purposes, and then to assess the proportionality of the processing in relation to these purposes and make sure you have a legal basis to do so. So a lot of the principles actually turn on accountability, transparency, and proportionality. So moving on from that, the key messages that are contained in the union position are, first of all, that in line with what I just said, you need to clearly define the purposes for which you are doing data processing, and you have to transparently inform the registrant about it. And there, of course, the models are a helpful step forward because they help us see a bit more of the details around what is happening there. But as we also said in the union position, a lot more detail is required to really be able to assess whether the purposes are legitimate, whether specific legal bases might apply, and whether the processing would be proportionate. The union also set out some considerations about the scope of application, which Brian and Steve already alluded to. So not everything is personal data, and the GDPR has a specific territorial scope. And I'm not quite sure whether the territorial scope as now set out in the convergence model really matches the criteria of the GDPR, but I will leave Christian to speak to that because he's the expert. The union position also states, and this is an important message, that we can pursue public interest in private contracts. Because here we are working in a special system. We don't have a law governing how the WHOIS is run or how ICANN is run. We're operating in a maze of bylaws and contracts that set out obligations for the contracted parties and for ICANN, some of which are not in the own interest of those contracted parties nor in that of ICANN, but this benefits a public interest purpose. And so I think this recognition that such public interest can be recognized in private law frameworks is very important. The union has also said elsewhere that legitimate interests, as laid down in union law, can also apply for the benefit of actors outside the union, which is an important thing to remember in this context. The union has also said that there is a clear need to improve the data quality, which clearly is not really very high at the moment, and that one of the requirements under the GDPR is to ensure a high data quality in relation to the purposes for which the data is processed. The union has also stated that there are some practical needs of law enforcement that should be taken into account, and I just will list a couple for the sake of examples, such as the access volume, so that there is still a possibility for law enforcement to have the kind of access that they require for the purposes of their investigation, and also very importantly that there be a mechanism to enable maintaining the confidentiality of law enforcement investigations. And again, here we come back to the details of the implementation, but those are important ones. I also want to clarify, because I heard that the union position has been misread as not endorsing the needs for other user groups to access the WHOIS. And that is not what the union position set out to do, but rather, again, the union position explicitly recognizes the GAC principles of 2007, which are quite eloquent also on the on other user groups. And here it is just important to again assess which user groups are given access for which purposes to which data categories, and to that that's proportionate. And that is really the main message that the union position tries to pass. It is not about whether you choose a layered access system. It is just one way of addressing some data protection concerns, and it can be a way of implementing that proportionality requirement. But in and of itself, such a layered access system does not yet justify the processing of the data for the purposes of the GDPR. And we will have to look carefully and specifically at the needs of each of the user groups and the legitimate purposes that arise on the basis of these needs. Now, the most urgent question is, how will this work? And here I come back to a point that Steve made earlier about the need for community participation. I think, and that's also in the union position quite explicit, the modules are still at a very abstract level. And really, we can only move to a true assessment of what is compatible with data protection rules and what meets user requirements once we start specifying further. And that is both a challenge and an opportunity because, of course, as users of the WHOIS, as stakeholders in the U.S., who is as registrants, registrars, registries, and ICANN, we can now participate in the elaboration of these models. And in that context, we welcome ICANN's efforts at reaching out to the DPAs and at attempting to further flesh out these models in an effort to meet the different needs, which is, of course, far from easy. And I just want to make it very clear also from the union position that the question of whether data is public or non-public is not per se required by the GDPR. The GDPR does not exclude, and neither does the Article 29 Working Party, that certain data elements, which could extend also to the registrant name and email address, could be made public. It just requires that there be a purpose, a legitimate purpose, and a legal basis that requires that that data be made publicly available, so just to clean up any misconceptions there. And with this, I will stop in the interest of allowing some time also for the others, but I'm happy to respond to questions now or at a later stage. Thank you.
Catherine, before we move on to the next presenter, this is Steve Del Bianco with a quick question for you. You noted that ICANN's models are abstract, but for purposes of discussion today, to move things down the road, it would be helpful if, while the other speakers are filling in, if you were to look at the convergence model as Brian described it earlier, give us your opinion or assessment about the degree to which that would be compliant with GDPR when we come back around to you on this panel. Thank you.
Sure, happy to. So should I turn over to Christian, who's in the room with me?
Yes, Catherine, please go ahead and turn it over to Christian. Thank you so much.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon. It's Christian Vicuna. I work for the European Data Protection Supervisor. Thanks for the invitation. It's disclaimer time as well for me that I don't represent the Article 29 Working Party. I work for the EDPS, which is a member of the Article 29 Working Party. We're not even the rapporteur, like the lead data protection authority on this important question within the working group. So, we don't have any mandate to speak on behalf of the group. Having said all of that, it's very good to keep this conversation going. The working party has been open to talking about this for many years. I know that we've had discussions with representatives of ICANN on many occasions in recent years, and I think ICANN have been in touch with different DPAs as well for like one-to-one discussions. I think the discussions opened with the working party back in 2003. There have been letters in 2006, 2014. The latest one was in December 2017. We know that there is a lot of work going on at the moment. But having said all of that, I'm sort of coming at this discussion rather blind because I don't know what these options are, which are on the table. I got these slides just before I left late for this meeting, so I've had a chance to glance at them, but. Hopefully this is the first opportunity of many to explore how they might interact with the GDPR. The working party holds very firmly to having a coherent approach on this. It's on the agenda almost every time they have a plenary meeting. The last one was a few weeks ago, and so they're very much speaking with one voice. On this, I'm not aware whether or not they've seen the options themselves, like different DPAs there. I don't think we have any DPS, but we want to take a coherent approach. The position that we would take, I suppose, as EDPS in general terms, is that obviously what we're talking about here is something which goes to the constitution of the European Union. So the right to data protection, the right to privacy, these are fundamental rights. So we take them very seriously. The internet as well is an organ for the fundamental right to freedom of expression. So it can help underpin democracy as well. So we don't see any in principle conflict between between data flows and protecting individuals who might be affected by the misuse of data or the unnecessary collection of data. But in relation to data of registered domain names, we're conscious that we haven't found a satisfactory solution yet. From May this year, it will be clear because of the GDPR, although you could argue that it always has been clear. As Catherine said, there is no great step change in the law through the GDPR, but it does make it clearer than ever in the GDPR that registrars offering services to people in the EU will be subject to the rules of the EU, and therefore they could be subject to enforcement by supervisory authorities in the EU if there is no way is found to protect the data in the domain name registration systems. So where does that leave us? Well, you've probably seen the letter that the DPAs wrote in December. I think there's still a question mark over, you know, understanding what the concept is under the GDPR, under EU law, of what personal data is. I noted your slide on the types of data that would be kept public or kept on the non-public register, be non-public and be publicly available. But the basic principle and the way that the law is evolving in the EU with case law and through the courts is that any sort of unlimited, indiscriminate disclosure of personal information is generally regarded to be disproportionate and therefore not compatible with EU law. So any proposal to publish in an unlimited sense individual domain name holders would raise serious concerns. You'd need to demonstrate, as Catherine said, that there is a legitimate purpose and a legal ground for doing it, which are two separate tests. One key innovation we would say in the GDPR is the notion of accountability. And what this means is that everything, the whole sort of ecosystem, the architecture of the new regulation revolves around the notion of the controller and the controller's responsibilities. And that, I think, has been one of the most difficult things in our discussions with ICANN to really nail down. But you'll see from the letter that was written in December from the working party that it seemed to us that ICANN and the registries jointly determine the purposes and means of data processing for directories, therefore that they would be deemed to be joint controllers. That was just a provisional view. And if starting from that basis, then you would then need to consider what would be the legal basis for publication of this information, publication being a form of data processing, which would have a big impact on the individual who's concerned by the data. There are different legal bases to consider, but consent seems to be the most obvious one. But there are some very strict rules about how consent is to be interpreted. So if it's not freely given, then it's not deemed to be consent under the GDPR. So that could be a challenge. The last couple of points. We've recommended having layered access to the data which is held in the directories. From your slides, again, I've only just seen them, but it looks as though it's the sort of thing that you're looking into. We don't dispute the fact that law enforcement or other authorities might need to have access to this, but the question is under what terms and to what extent, and what the controls and safeguards in place are. So the last point is that the kind of enforcement regime which will come in from May this year, if ICANN were to be considered a joint controller, that would mean that they would be subject to the General Data Protection Regulation. They would need to indicate one or more establishments in the EU, or appoint, if it was outside the EU, they'd need to appoint a representative in the EU, and then it would be, you know, be a, the one-stop shop could be invoked, which means that the data protection authorities would gather together and decide which authority should be in the lead if you indicate that the that ICANN has establishment in more than one member state. So that's really all I can say at this point. I'm sorry if it's what you've heard already before, my boss is very keen for me to come here, mainly to be in listening mode and to find out how you're getting on with these difficult discussions.
No, that's great. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your perspective and we appreciate your time, and that was incredibly helpful. And now I'd like to turn it over to Paolo Gracia.
Hi, thank you very much. And I would be very short, and thank you very much for inviting Etno to contribute as part of the ISP constituency. We, as an association of network operators, represent telecom operators, European telecom operators that have been data privacy directive compliant, will be GDPR compliant going forward. But we have a keen interest of having ICANN as compliant as possible, because we take the view of users, of course, of who is, and the way we interact with the registers is really important for us. And I would like just to draw on a couple of points that were raised right now from previous speaker, and indeed I looked with a lot of interest at the letter from the Working Party 29 of the 11th of December that gives some good a good analysis. Of course, the analysis is based on the current model, not on the new model. So if you see the key point is what are the legal grounds for processing for publication, who is data by ICANN. And it seems at first glance indeed that the Working Party 29 at the first analysis is discarding most of the most obvious legal grounds, because as it was rightly said, the consent seems to not to be freely given, because the absence of consent would result in denial of the service. Performance of a contract is a legal ground that couldn't be pursued, because the domain name holder is not a party of the contract, and this doesn't seem to bound to change under the converge model. At the same time, I think that the legitimate interest concept is really interested in view of your converged model you're moving towards, because the reason why Working Party 29 say that legitimate interest is not acceptable under the current model is because it's not proportionate, and you can't be granted legitimate interest for an unlimited publication of all data over the internet. Of course, it's not for me, not for anyone in this room to judge whether legitimate interest would be a good way to go under the converge model, but it seems from your preliminary presentation that there is some improvement, because your converge model wouldn't imply an undiscriminate publication of data, so you have public and non-public WHOIS data, and the set of public data as seen as I read them of course wouldn't easily read to an identification of the data subject, as you know, as raised by the European Commission in their letter. They point out to the new definition, the new concept of personal data, which is very, very broad, and it involves personally identifiable information, but also information that could lead to an identification of the data subject. And I think there may be chances that these separation of public and non-public data under this criteria, and these two different data sets may lead to a more lenient approach from the DPAs. But this is, as an observer, an opening that I see. But of course, what I wanted to stress also strong of the experience of our members is that prior consultation with the DPAs is of essence here. In fact, under the GDPR, the data controller is required to run a risk assessment, and if the processing he wants to pursue may lead to high risk for the data subject, the controller should involve and consult the DPA before finalizing and this processing operation. But in fact, what we have seen from
that's choreography.
Exactly. Staff, are we able to mute that line, please?
Hi, Brian. I'm working on that right now. My apologies. I have no idea where that's coming from, but I will certainly find it.
Thank you so much. It was an unplanned classical interlude.
I'm so sorry. Oh, dear God.
They apparently only bought 5 bars of music. Feels like we're back in the 1990s of conference calls.
So I think that indeed before I can complete this converged model, I would just suggest not.
Did we just mute the presenter?
Sorry, can you hear us?
Hi,
yes, we can.
We've got the host in the room.
Yeah.
Can you guys all hear now?
Yeah, sure. So,
okay, apologies for that. That was the only way I could get it to stop. So we should be able to carry on. I'm sorry about that. Thank you for your patience, everyone.
No problem. This happens. And I was just concluding that, as also stressed in the EPA's letter, prior consultation before the model is finalized is of essence, because I think it's something that usually should happen to submit a complete model and complete a rule book for processing to DPAs for approval before they've been consulted thoroughly. So that's just my message.
Catherine, this is Steve DelBianco. Thank you, Paulo. Catherine, if you had an opportunity to assess the first few pages of the slides that Brian circulated, mainly with respect to what described specifically in the ICANN convergence model, and give us your view on whether you believe it would be compliant with GDPR.
Thank you, Steve, for putting me on the spot. I'm looking at a question here. I mean, I think what is in the model is per se not necessary. I mean, could be in line with the GDPR, but really, as Christian was saying, I was trying also to convey, we need to look a lot further than this to determine whether it meets the GDPR's requirements, because really, you can say you have a layered access model, but then whether that is data protection compliant or not will depend on to whom you give access to the non-public parts, which parts you keep public, and for which purposes, on which legal basis. and how you construct a system that ensures the kind of accountability that Christian and I were referring to. And that's what I meant when I said we need a bit more detail here, because I think there's a lot of options now for taking this forward, and differentiated access is definitely a very good step in the right direction from the data protection perspective. I'm looking at Christian here, who's not shaking his head, so I'm still on safe ground. But we need to look at how that will work in practice in order to be able to assess whether it meets, A, the needs of the users, and, B, the requirements of the GDPR, both of which need to be met and reconciled. And the GDPR has a number of pretty solid mechanisms for this, and as soon as we start elaborating, we can start exploring whether those mechanisms give us the green light. I'm just looking at Christian, whether he wants to add anything. So I'm not the only
one. Well, I mean, if you play the whole of that violin concerto, I might have more to say after thinking about it. But the, I mean, I really can't say. I mean, you can't make a judgment on compliance on the basis of a few slides that have only just been seen. So, I mean, I appreciate the, you know, that there is a lot of work obviously behind all of this, but there are a number of basic questions, you know, in the which have been repeatedly put by the working party. So I think, you know, they would expect to see, you know, a more systematic engagement with those questions. There's not a big, I mean, the GDPR is a very important development, but it's not. Things haven't really changed from the directive. The principles are still the same. There's still the need to have a legal basis and a purpose and purpose limitation, you know, a notion of who's ultimately responsible for the decisions that are being taken. Sorry, I can't.
Christian.
Yeah.
Thank you, Christian. Steve Del Bianco. Just a follow up. I would wonder though, to say nothing has changed ignores the stark reality that come May, fines of 4% of gross global turnover can be imposed. That is certainly perceived as a step change, although I realize from your perspective, you may not see a step change in regard to what the policy is, but when the policy includes fines, I have to suggest that is perceived as a step change. And my question for you would be that let's suppose that the model is published, as ICANN suggested, within the next several days, and with far more specificity as to the criteria by which the non-public information could be revealed, to Catherine's point. Once that is published, can you say whether the DPA, a lead DPA prior to the formation of the Data Protection Board, would a lead DPA be able to very quickly assess and give approval of ICANN's interim model soon enough that it can be relied upon for the programming and compliance activities that parties have to undertake?
Well, the first point, you're right. Fines is an innovation in the GDPR, and it's an important one. I don't want to downplay it at all. But on the other hand, there are I wouldn't hold your breath before the first fine is applied, because if you read the articles in question, you know there are some very complex criteria which need to be satisfied before if that tool of enforcement is used collectively by the DPA. So I don't think people should be overly obsessed with fines. What it's based, fines are basically built into the system in order to create a realization that these things are very important, and you know there is genuine harm that can take place to the individual if information about them is used in the wrong way, in a disrespectful way. On the second point, I don't know. It's a sort of hypothetical question. I mean, I don't think the Article 29 Working Party meeting is the Article 29 Working Party between now and May. Could certainly look at, could certainly consider a model, and they would, the DPAs would be ready to work together to assess it and to give an opinion on it. I don't know how quickly they would do that. I mean, the The last meeting of the working group is in April. After that, they will meet again as the European Data Protection Board. So, you know, it would be there are 29 different authorities involved in the working party. So, they'd need to work very quickly in order to get you a response. And I can't guarantee that would be forthcoming before 25th of May. But it's, you know, there's no harm in trying, and I think they'd appreciate the gesture. They might. I mean, you'll know that, you know, they've been a bit disappointed that there hasn't been more progress over the last 15 years. And obviously now that there's 3 months to go before the GDPR, people are starting to have a sense of urgency. But having said all of that, I wouldn't, you know, speaking on behalf of EDPS, I wouldn't expect the world to suddenly change overnight. You know, it's
Christian, a quick follow-up question to that. We hear you that it may take some additional time for feedback to be given on the model. There has been talk potentially about a forbearance in enforcement while we seek final approval and to give potentially parties time to actually implement. Is that something that you think is a possibility and that you think may be considered?
Well, there's no provision in the law for a kind of grace period, but, you know, it's all about engagement with the DPAs and showing, you know, being proactive, being sincere in your risk assessment, and, you know, those efforts get recognised. So it's not really, I mean, it's not the case that, you know, you can suddenly suspend your enforcement powers. It's more like trying to make sure that the best possible outcome is achieved. So, yeah, it's not as simple as that. Sorry, I think we need to hear some more music again.
Well, no, we're not asking you to make anything up. We do appreciate you answering the questions to the best of your ability. Laureen Capen has a question.
Thanks, Christian. I'm here. Bum, 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 bum. So now you can answer my question, which is, since we know that ICANN has an office, a major office in Brussels, and the working party has the view that ICANN is a joint controller, I'm wondering if that weighs in favor or makes it more likely that the Brussels DPA might be the lead one-stop shop for ICANN compliance issues.
Well, it said the letter was just a sort of preliminary assessment that they could be joint controllers. But then it goes on to say that, you know, at least under the GDPR, they'll need to indicate, you know, where the joint controllers are established. I mean, if they're established in different places, then, you know, the group will decide who would take the lead. So, you know, if you were to say that ICANN, you know, most of the big decisions are taken in Brussels, then they would say that then there'd be a strong case saying that the Belgian DPA would take the lead. But this is all kind of speculation, because there are all sorts of, you know, there are some procedural steps that need to be taken under the GDPR to establish who the lead authority is amongst the DPAs.
Great, thank you so much. I have one quick question, which could be, I guess, for Catherine, Christian, or Paolo. We've had some discussions about the data accuracy requirements that are in the GDPR and what those mean, potentially in terms of who is. And I'm wondering if any of you have any thoughts on that or interpretations, because we know within our community we've had some very different perspectives on what that could mean.
Right. I mean, the principle, this is Catherine, the principle of the GDPR is that personal data should be accurate and kept up to date, and inaccurate data should be erased or rectified without delay. And it has to be with regard to the purposes for which they are processed. So obviously for a number of purposes, the data would need to be accurate. but what that exactly would mean in terms of the obligations for the registrars and registries to verify data that has been inputted by the registrants is, I think, a somewhat more complicated question. I'm looking at Christian whether he has any additional input, but it's not something that, I mean, the requirement is clear, but to what extent, measures need to be taken, that would need to be further specified.
Yes, well, it all comes back to the controller again. They're responsible for the quality of the data, and the person who's concerned by the data, the data subject, they have a right to, if they consider the quality of the data to be defective, then they can ask for it to be rectified.
Great. Thank you so much. We're going to ask any other questions you put into the chat, and then for follow-up later. We are running a bit behind schedule, so we want to move forward to our next panel. Thank you so much, Catherine, Christian, and Paolo. This was incredibly helpful, and we really appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us and also answering our questions.
Brian, is there still a question from Brussels? So for the record, this is Alexander Herweg from the PTO law firm. As an EU lawyer, for me there's something missing in this whole discussion which I haven't seen yet, or maybe I missed it, so correct me if I'm wrong. But as my previous speakers already iterated, so the introduction of the GDPR is not a step change. It's still primary an harmonization of existing laws which have been around for many years. So what I'm wondering is, why are we not talking about the WHOIS policy of existing EU CCTLD registries, or maybe EURID as the main example? As it stands, it seems to me that their WHOIS policy or EURID's WHOIS policy is less strict than the convergence model shown here today. For example, they do make a distinction between legal and natural persons, and they publish the email address and language of the registrant who is a natural person. So I'm not aware what steps are taken by EURID or other European registries to further comply with the GDPR, which has obviously stricter obligations. But it seems to me that this would be an important part of the discussion, or should at least be discussed, and I haven't heard this yet, so I don't know if there are any comments on this.
If I may, this is Catherine from the European Commission, which so we're in charge of the .eu, and we have delegated this to EURID for implementation. And I agree with you that EURID is exemplary in many ways, because it has a very solid data access policy, it has a very solid anti-abuse policy, and that leads to, and it has some publicly available WHOIS data which satisfies most of the public access needs. So they actually see a very low volume of WHOIS requests, also because they keep their space clean. And I have to say very clearly that there's a clear link between the number of WHOIS lookups needed and the abuse mitigation measures that a registry takes. And so while we think that from these perspectives it's very useful, there would be a complication in scaling up this model, which is that EURID currently has a practice of making you fill in a form for each WHOIS request, and if you have a larger volume of lookups, obviously needing to fill this form every time would create a certain obstacle for a number of users who need more access. And it works for EURID again because they don't have all that many lookups, but it just is not a scalable model in terms of the way the self-certification process operates at the moment. So if that were to be adjusted, of course, self-certification is one of the things under discussion.
But I'll stop here. Sorry, Steve, we're throwing you off the schedule.
No problem. Thank you so much, Claudia, for answering that question. I'm sorry, Catherine, for answering that question. We really appreciate it, and it is an interesting perspective. We are going to need to move on to our next panel now. Again, I want to thank Catherine, Christian, and Paolo for their time and for indulging all of our questions. And we're going to move on from latest developments in the EU, and we're going to turn over to Claudia Selle, Chair of the BC, to begin our...
Thank you very... Sure.
Sorry, yes, please, Claudia, go ahead and get our discussion started on who is user perspective on ICANN convergence model. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, first of all, Steve and Brian, for putting a lot of effort in organizing this webinar. As the previous one, I think it's very useful as we go towards the adoption of a final model of compliance to continue the discussion between the exchange between communities and constituencies and ICANN, because it helps really to clarify some questions, concerns, and also to hear the different interests and at stake. And secondly, thank you very much also for giving me this opportunity to share the BC views concerning the convergence model. The BC has made clear in different stances that, of course, we would be in favor of Model 1, as we think, and we think that the convergence Model 1 has still some missing element. One of the elements that we think should be considered is certainly the geographical scope of application. In fact, the model of convergence would apply, as Brian also pointed before, globally, regardless of whether the registrar and registry and also where the processing fails within the scope of the regulation, thus adding some burdens, of course, and also, I mean, the limits or the request of the GDPR would be felt in other region and maybe also more critical areas, and maybe where also, you know, users might need to have access to UEs in a consistent way. It wouldn't be possible also in other region globally. And I also think that this would go against the public policy and might lead to some conflicts of law in other jurisdiction. Also, as it was pointed before, the convergence model would also apply to legal person, and as the Commission has pointed out in the letter of 7th of February, the GDPR only applies to natural persons, so there is really no need also to regulate the data of legal persons. The other thing is that the model doesn't, from what I understand, distinguish between the data subject and third party. It's currently not really clear. And in fact, if the requester is the data subject, it shouldn't require to go through the same type of requirements as the third party, as in fact the data subject would be entitled to access the data and has the right to accuracy and to, you know, correct the data. In terms, moving to another aspect, in terms of access to non-public WIS data, of course it gives access to a defined set of third parties certified under an accreditation certification program. It's not really clear how the certification program will run, and we are waiting, of course, for the details in order to give a judgment or also to have an opinion. I would guess that this would enable a one-time approval over a specified period. And although we would support the standardized accreditation process, we think as well that it requires a lot of work to put it in place. So in the interim solution, we would favor a robust self-certification process in meanwhile. And in fact, the robust self-certification process, which is currently under Model 1, it would give access, quick access, while being compliant with the GDPR requirements. In fact, as Catherine has pointed out earlier, the Article 29 working party doesn't say, I mean, would allow to publish certain data if there is the legitimate interest, of course, and if it's proportionate. And I wanted also to stress that for private actors, private sector companies, researcher, IP right holders, it would be critical to maintain the access to public data while respecting the GDPR. And in fact, you know, the model, I mean, we would certainly support the fact that it allows the collection of TIC data, but at the same time, I'm a bit concerned about the fact that it doesn't allow for publication of certain data such as mail or ID, and because it can have some consequences in the search, the way, for example, the reverse WIS function. In fact, I mean, the benefit of WIS is quite known, and I think also the institutions are recognizing that. The other day I participated into a roundtable on cybersecurity, and Commissioner King, responding to a question on how GDPR would impact some uses, some services, he precisely pointed to the benefit of WIS and the importance of keeping it accurate, particularly for law enforcement, of course. And in fact, I wanted to highlight five, for example, uses of WIS, how WIS is beneficial to consumers and companies alike. First of all, you can identify a malicious website. A domain record is a very handy and preliminary point to figure whether a website is potentially harmful or may be involved in cyber theft. And a lot of factors can raise red flags. For example, if the registration, there is a recent date of registration for a domain, or a fairly close expiration date of the domain, or if the registrant comes from a high-risk country, or, for example, if the registrant and a company address are different in location. So with the reverse WIS, you are able, in fact, to also see other sites that are being registered by the same entity or by the same registrant, and so to find out also other possible fraudulent sites. The second use is to identify fraudulent entities. So the third would be certainly to identify different associations for fraudulent activity, identified fraudulent domain with DNS, and credit card fraud. Fraudulent activities, of course, over the Internet can be also very dangerous, because if you think about counterfeited pharmaceutical, it can be even deadly, or if you think about counterfeited automotive parts that wouldn't function, or counterfeited, for example, even furniture. If you buy a crib for your son or daughter, I mean for your baby, you don't want to put your baby in a counterfeited crib that can lead to injuries, for example. So you would be able to discover whether the website, would be fraudulent or not. The last element that I wanted to bring into the discussion is the interim model versus a long-term strategy. And in fact, of course, the community is quite worried about the final decision that ICANN will take and when, because, of course, this wouldn't leave much time for registry to implement it. But as the Commission suggested, we should have, and as Steve pointed out, we should have a good discussion at community level in order for all parties to be heard, all concerns to be heard, and maybe find a satisfactory solution. And, of course, we can take this momentum where the model has been outlined to continue the discussion, and also maybe it's a way to accelerate the PDP towards the policy framework that complies with the GDPR. And so we can certainly restart and continue the RDS PDP. So I think these are some questions that I wanted to throw on the table, and I would like all of us to think about that and not to to focus only on the interim model. And we'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Claudia. I'm now going to turn the mic over to Lori Schulman, Senior Director of Internet Policy at the International Chamber of Goods Association, to discuss trademark, brand, and IP perspectives.
Sure.
Actually, we switched up the order on you, Brian, if that's okay. This is Timothy Chen with Domain Tools on behalf of the business constituency. Thank you, Claudia, for those comments. I will be very brief, and then I will be passing the mic to Lori. First, I just want to say that, you know, we acknowledge the rights to privacy of everyone worldwide, not just European citizens, and the importance of this process, the critical fundamental roles that the European DPAs, as well as ICANN, play in this process, and the challenging situation that the contracted parties are in. And our hope in all of this is to try and come to a workable solution, because for us individually,
the security and stability of the Internet and the safety of individuals and employees of the businesses that we represent are of primary importance. I'm going to touch on just two meta points and then pass the mic to Lori. I will also say that the use cases, which is one of the topics here, there's documentation in the EWG, the very good EWG work, as well as in the RDS work that people can refer to for specific examples of the use cases that Claudia was talking about. Well, the first point that I want to make is that DNS is, by its definition, an open, trust-based network. The function of DNS and of the Internet and the continuing function of the Internet and the security and stability of the Internet for which ICANN is responsible is dependent on protecting that trust. Another way of looking at trust, if you flip it on its head, is risk. And, you know, what folks in security and brand protection are doing on a daily basis is trying to do a risk assessment, either individually in understanding who's on the other end of a DNS transaction for which we believe they have a right to know, as well as at scale for some of the more forward-looking security use cases for the data, which we can talk about another time. So fundamentally, it's important to protect that trust. And if you look at DNS, it's really a many-to-many network. And the challenge with a gating process is that the information becomes a many-to-few paradigm. And in those cases, and you think about that, you think about the fact that while people think about security being done by large organizations or a couple very smart people inside these big security operations centers worldwide, it's actually done every day tens of millions of times at the edge of the network, individuals, people like you and me, our families, our employees, making decisions on where they go and why they go there on the Internet. And enforcing security at that level is fundamentally almost where it's the most important. And the remit of the business constituency extends security to individual Internet users because they are our customers. And so they're making decisions on whether or not the website they're going to is actually the website of the business or not. It's just one use case. And so we think about this. We think about the business constituency and the ITC. We're also thinking about Internet users worldwide by definition. And so when I think about those two things, the fact that security is done at the edge of the network and the fact that a gating process creates a many-to-few information flow, it becomes a primary importance what sits outside of that gate and what people at scale are allowed to do, because I don't believe that the credentialing process is going to allow credentialing for Internet users worldwide at any scale or functionality. And then separately, of course, what happens inside that gate is also of primary importance. And Laura will be talking about one example of that with the email address. Claudia's already talked about all of the use cases. I had a lot prepared for that, so I'll skip that. I will just say that the other point that I wanted to make is that, and I know something about this just from the practice of the business that we've been in for 20 years, the effective establishment of that trust happens both on an individual domain basis as well as at scale. This is the concept of searchable who is, which also Lori, I believe, is going to touch upon. But really, when you think about our constituents in network and cybersecurity, in IP and brand protection, in anti-fraud, and all the related use cases that we're trying to represent today, there are use cases for both the individual lookup and the information about a domain name that's currently captured in the WHOIS protocol, as well as the ability to connect other Internet resources, domains, their hosting infrastructure, to that actor in order to establish context and then precipitate whatever kind of legal process, takedown, blocking, remediation that you're trying to, investigation that you're trying to do on your network for your users, for your employees, for your brands and IP and your organization. And so it is important to talk about that. And I'll echo what people have said here. Driving towards this model of how that's going to happen, what's allowed behind the gate, is of primary importance, so people in those fields can understand the capabilities, what they're going to be able to do going forward after May 25th. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Lori Schulman, and I am the Senior Director for Internet Policy for the International Trademark Association. And I want to thank Tim and Claudia for sort of teeing up some large issues that I'd like to address in terms of the gaps in the conversion model and where we feel there is definitely more room for discussion. There are three key areas. One is including a real email address in front public-facing WHOIS. We feel that's absolutely critical There is a letter with justification written on behalf of the Coalition for Online Accountability, which is an association of content owners, and they are members of the intellectual property constituency. It's on ICANN's website. I was going to go through the points today, but actually, in the interest of time, I'm going to ask those to reference the letter. It is on the ICANN website, which goes into why it's important to have an actual email address with a real name, something that's contactable, that we can get to providers of whatever services are being offered on, under a domain name quickly, for a variety of reasons, and I'll just highlight a few. One, if someone's website is under attack, the quickest way to inform them is through a real email address rather than going through some sort of layered system. Secondarily, for those of us who are very much interested in the consumer protection aspects of and the applicability of who is, the best way to understand who may be either intentionally or unintentionally creating confusion on the web in terms of the source of a particular good or service under a trademark or of content, that that source be very readily contacted, because not all controversies end in court. A lot of the correspondence and the notice and the takedown and the operations to get bad actors off the web is done through WHOIS. So the importance of keeping a real email address public-facing, we see, isn't necessarily precluded by GDPR. This was very well explained to us by our European colleagues. That being said, Catherine Bauer both mentioned, and we emphasize, the importance of improving accuracy on the WHOIS. We don't see anything in the convergence model right now that talks about accuracy. And it's going to take the opportunity to comply with GDPR, to essentially close off some data sources that we're used to having, then at least those that we have should be much more accurate. We all know that the WHOIS is notoriously inaccurate. And in spite of the inaccuracies, I've read statistics that say it's up 50 to 75%, depending whose studies you look at. There's still accurate data there, but it would be better now to have even more reliability and accountability as to who is the owner of a domain. It's really that simple. We're also concerned about bulk inquiries. Bulk inquiries help cybersecurity experts, consumer protection advocates, brand owners, content owners to figure out patterns, important patterns, in what is becoming an exponentially growing problem with phishing, malware, and all the other little presents that one can encounter. A normal consumer going to a website they think is from a particular source. It's not from a particular source. They provide information. The information then is used for identity theft. The quickest way to get at solving these problems, who's doing the bad acts, is to get to a real email address, accurate information, and then analyzing patterns through bulk access. Fundamentally, though, this does come down to the gating question. And that has, I think, also been very well portrayed today, that we're talking about this convergence model at such a high level that we don't understand how access will happen, when access will happen. Will it be only limited to law enforcement? Will it only be limited to lawyers? I've heard, well, there are some models that say, well, let's provide access to IP attorneys. And that's great. We welcome that. But there's a broader universe of interested private parties out there. It's not just IP attorneys. It's private investigators. It's service providers. It's people who have a stake in and an interest in making sure that the Internet is a clean, safe space for consumers. And I'm going to end it right there. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Any questions for our speakers? Steve?
For the presentations, and I want to follow on to Rory's presentation in particular, but it also really comes back to the impact of the third parties who are not likely to be plausible gating scenario accreditation, like these guys, such as the consumers around the world getting access to be able to contact.
Thank you. Among the people who will not
be included in any plausible accreditation scenario or the consumers around the world who need access to this. But one other aspect of that is that if these consumers no longer have access to a registrant email address and cannot contact the owner of the domain name in order to determine, you know, as a previous speaker said, whether the crib is defective, or who's going to be responsible for the crib, where are they going to turn? I'm assuming they're going to turn to the contracted parties. They're going to be turning to the registrars for this information. One consequence of suppressing public access to register and email, which is what appears to be in the convergence model, is going to be an increased burden on registrars, either to act upon requests that they receive from consumers and from, I'll give another example, investigative journalists. Every day we see stories in the press in the United States anyway, and I'm sure in Europe, where there's a big concern about fake news in social media and so forth. Every day we see stories that clearly are based upon or in which WHOIS data is used for the investigative journalists, and they will, again, not be in any plausible scenario, will not be accredited. So all these people will be coming to the contracted parties. Are the contracted parties prepared to deal with both a higher volume and the potential liability if they do not actually provide this information to these requesters? So I just wanted to put that perspective in as well.
Thank you, Steve. Laureen?
Thanks. Quick question, and this may be for our GP.
We can't hear you.
Hello?
Brian, do you hear us?
We hear you. I think we're having trouble with Laureen's mic.
Now, okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, sorry about that. Building on the issue of data accuracy, and this may be for our DPA folks, there was mention that the GDPR actually has obligations to correct inaccurate information, and that it's unclear what this means specifically for registries and registrars. But I'm wondering, in terms of standing, is it only the who has the standing to raise the issue of inaccurate data? It can't just be the registrant, because the registrant many times is giving the inaccurate data. So I'm just wondering if the standing to raise this issue goes to anyone who may be harmed by the fact that the data is inaccurate, or it's some other analysis.
Normally it would be the person who is concerned by the data, but if it's that's under data protection law, but if it's a question of generally inaccurate data, then I would assume that that can be raised with the authority, with the regulator. It doesn't have to be the data subject themselves. It's an interesting question. I don't think there'd be any block to someone bringing the case forward.
Great, thank you so much. I think that's a super helpful point, and again, an issue that we're trying to work through and figuring out what the data accuracy means and who would have the ability to make an objection. I think this is actually a good segue to our next topic. I want to thank Claudia, Lori, and Tim for providing the perspective of the user with regard to the ICANN convergence model. One of the challenges that we see moving forward is the creation of a certification or accreditation system. One of the concerns we have with the convergence model is that we see lots of things going dark from a public-facing standpoint, and we don't have a clear picture yet of how access is going to be granted and to the extent of information that the people who are granted access are going to have it in terms of both
time duration, and scope. So I wanted to actually turn things over to Susan Kawaguchi and Alex Deacon to kick off our discussion on this topic.
Great. Thanks, Brian. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. This is Alex Deacon, and hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. So as we kind of stated that its high-level goal in these discussions is to maintain to the greatest extent possible the amount of data still available in the public HWIS system while complying with the GDPR. We agree this is an important goal, but we do understand that some registration information may no longer be publicly available, and that some form of gated or tiered access to this data, leveraging the technical capabilities of a protocol like RDAP, for example, will be necessary. I think when thinking about tiered access, there's some things that need to be taken into consideration. I think first, it must minimize burdens not only on registrars and registries, but also on third parties who have legitimate interest in seeking access to this non-public data. And second, it must provide for expedited access, reliability and consistency while still complying with the GDPR. So Susan and I have been asked to talk about how the ICANN community should go about designing and eventually implementing systems that will allow access to registration data that is no longer publicly available. With the May 2018 date quickly approaching, I think we could all agree that we need to be thinking about a phased approach, one that allows us to be up and running at the end of May with an interim process based on self-certification that will ensure continue yet now controlled access to important data contained in the WHOIS system. And in parallel, we need to start on the definition of a longer-term, more robust accreditation system that could take us and move us forward into the future. So I'm going to chat a little bit about requirements for self-certification that we could use in the interim, and then I'll pass it on to Susan to talk about a longer-term solution, one based on formal accreditation. So in any system based on self-certification, the requester must certify that it needs access to the data for one of the ICANN-defined purposes. For example, those purposes that have been outlined in all three of ICANN's proposed interim models, which include law enforcement, cybersecurity, consumer protection, intellectual property interest, and the like. A requester of information must also certify that it will comply with the GDPR when processing WHOIS data it receives. The IPC, in one of its comments, put some details around additional requirements for self-certification. They are on the slide. I'm not going to read all of this, but I'll just go through it quickly. When requesting access to information, we believe that self-certification regimes need to ask for the name of the requester. I need to understand if the requester is an individual, the name of that person, the address of the requester, email address, phone number, and then, of course, the purpose of the request based on one of the five purposes set forth by the ICANN interim model. And then a self-certification model, this requester would agree under penalty of perjury to several conditions, and I won't read these, but you'll see them now up on slide 19. So I won't read these. You could take a look at the slide and also the IPC comments. The bottom line here is that if the requester properly completes items 1 through 6 and affirms to items listed in seven there, then the registrar or the registry should grant immediate access to the non-public data of the requester. And we think the self-certification process would comply with the GDPR for a number of reasons. First, it limits the use of the data by the requester to a legitimate purpose and imposes obligations on the requester to process and use the data in compliance with the GDPR and any other applicable laws. So it embraces the principles relating to the processing of personal data set forth in Article 5 of the GDPR, for example. And second, because the self-certification affirms in item 7B that the requested data will potentially be used to establish, exercise, or defend a legal claim, either civil or criminal, it serves to relieve the registrar of balancing the interests of the registrant and requester with respect to the right to object set forth in Article 21 of the GDPR. And finally, we believe it's important to ensure that we all agree up front that the self-certification process is interim and short-term. And we would suggest that that a date be set, an expiration date for any interim process that may be agreed to be set, for example, end of December 2018 or some other dates, to give us incentives to actually come up with a more formal and final accreditation, a formal accreditation process at that date. So with that, I'll pass it over to Susan, who'll talk about the long game here and how we can address a formal accreditation process. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. This is Susan Calgucci. We have one question. Steve Del Bianco?
Alex, Steve Del Bianco, in the chat I placed the question, can you cite any examples of where a similar form of self-certification, such as what you've described, is being used by European registry operators today?
I think, thanks, Steve. This is Alex. Yeah, so I think, you know, we've seen a form of self-certification being proposed that in the .Amsterdam TLD, I believe something similar is outlined for .EU. So these things do exist today, and we would build from those and perhaps learn from those in whatever interim self-certification process that we may come up with.
We have another question in the room.
Hi, this is Irango with the FBI. I just had a question if you saw that this self-certification being applicable at the individual level, or if there is a mechanism for having a whole organization in the sense that we would have an issue if each individual investigator need to go through this process just in terms of its expediency for an investigation.
Yeah, thanks, Aranga. This is Alex. I mean, I think clearly that we want to make sure that, that we meet the requirements, or at least one of the requirements that I stated up front is that it needs to kind of minimize burdens on the registries and registrars who will have to process these applications, but also to those who will be, you know, taking advantage or using the credentials issued and having access to the data. So I think there are ways that we can achieve that, having a single application, for example, for an organization, I think is one way to do that. So I think we envision that this would work for organizations as a whole and the employees that need access to that information, the investigators, for example, but also to individuals, and as the case may be.
Becky, another question in the room.
Thanks. This is Becky Burr. I think that this self-certification question sort of begs that question of how do we get to answers that help us bridge the gap here. I think that if you talk to registries and registrars and other folks, there's a great deal of anxiety about whether a self-certification process would pass GDPR muster. And in order to, and I understand, on the other hand, why it's attractive and useful from other perspectives, and in some way it would simplify, if it actually worked, it would simplify compliance and the need to create an accreditation system and the like. But the question really is, how do we get to some level of clarity with respect to whether it passes muster or not? Because I don't think there's a great deal of confidence that it does.
Alex, would you like to respond first to that?
Sure. I think it's a great question, and I think in order to understand if something passes muster, we need to, as a community, come together to define what we think it should look like, and then ask for input from the DPAs and others who are experts. I think it seems to me that there is a path forward if we were to do that. But I agree, Becky, ultimately that is the question. Will this pass muster? Given that we'll put some thought into it, that there will be defined processes and requirements, that requesters will agree to handle the data per the GDPR. I think that leads us, and also the fact that it's interim and that we will be using it, we will eventually be moving on to something more permanent, which perhaps is better, if you will, in the eyes of the GDPR. I think it seems to me that it is definitely possible, but the question I think needs to be asked of those who are kind of in the data protection space to give us guidance there on how to best do that.
And this is Susan, and I agree that it will be at the best sort of a guess, but we definitely need to balance the GDPR versus consumer protection, and it's not sustainable to all of a sudden have no access to those records come May 25th. So I'm hoping that ICANN can take a stance on this. And maybe the authorities in Europe will understand that it's a work in progress and that we can continually change the model. Hard for registrars to implement something that's changing, on a monthly basis, but hopefully we can all work together toward a model that the authorities can accept. And then there's always the risk involved. So we either have a consumer protection risk or a GDPR fine risk. I'm not sure which, I have an opinion on which outweighs the other, but I'm not sure that would be agreed upon. So I will take over here on the sort of the long-term requirements for a accreditation model. I think one of the first steps we should do after we've come up with a temporary model for self-certification is actually, as a community, agree on a framework, a document that we all sign on to, similar to what we did with the PPSAI in the privacy and proxy specification in the RAA, 2013 RAA. We all signed on to that. Registrars signed on to that. It was something we could turn to and say, okay, we have this responsibility. We've already agreed to this, and we need to make this move forward within a time frame. The December 2018 time frame that Alex was speaking about, that's quite aggressive. Can we get there? But we should, what we don't want to do is end up with an agreement that times out over the years, and we're left with a model that doesn't really work, and that the registrars have a hard time implementing. So it's, I think one of our first tasks is to develop
a very short framework that everyone agrees to. And then, you know, part of the details that we need to look at is, can we determine organizations that will, within each of our communities, that could help with this validation process? You know, is there a cybersecurity community or group that could actually step forward and say, yes, they are a member of our group, we've validated their membership, they are responsible, whatever the details are, and sort of bless those individuals or companies to be part of, you know, be able to be part of the accreditation and gain access to the WHOIS. You know, it's been mentioned maybe WIPO or INTA would work in that function for IP and brand owners. Is there a copyright group? I mean, each of us need to go out to our communities and really think, who could stand there and validate for us? Are there other, we also, as a community, need to agree to all those legitimate and lawful purposes for disclosure. You know, the, there's been a lot of discussion on that. I'm not sure there's complete agreement on the actual purposes and the data elements that go along with a disclosure for those purposes. And so we would need to determine the level of access. And then, you know, there are a few groups out there that are already doing, that was sort of discussed in Alex's presentation, but DigiCert was brought to my attention in that they provide validation of registrants for .bank and .insurance. Could we take their model and maybe, you know, work on that? Can, you know, so instead of reinventing the wheel here, I think we should all go out, look at what's out there, and then also turn to work that we've already done as a community or has reviewed as a community. And the data, I won't go through all these data access principles, but these, I just pulled these from the EWG report. No surprise. I was on the EWG. But, you know, this was pretty well thought out, and we've discussed some of these in the RDS working group. And so it, maybe we can start here. I'm not saying let's just pick this up and say this is it, but maybe instead of going back to step one and drafting everything anew and really discussing it forever, maybe we start with something that's existing out there, something that most of the community is, you know, aware of. So, you know, I think we've done a lot of the work. We've known this was a problem coming. We've been aware of the challenges, and now we have a short timeline to come to terms and propose a model that works for all the parts of the community. So that's about all of my presentation. Any questions or concerns?
Susan, Phil Corn from VeriSign. For clarification, we all understand the interim model is going to be some type of self-certification. And I think everyone would agree that we want the permanent model to be adopted as quickly as possible, although I agree with you that December 2018 for having it in effect is aggressive, quote-unquote. You're on RDS. You're familiar. We're on EWG. I asked Steve, let me ask you and put it out in the room. Once the self-certification model is in place and we're moving within the ICANN community toward creating a permanent model, do you see that happening in terms of ICANN organization talking to the community and proposing something, or through the work of the RDS PDP, or through a CCWG because of governmental involvement? In other words, what's going to be the form, the institutional form for the path to the permanent model in your mind?
Only my opinion. Yeah. Please don't make it a PDP. But I think we're all on enough PDPs. You know, as part of the GNSO Council, we had a pretty in-depth discussion in January at our strategy meeting about making the PDPs more effective. There are other, types of groups that are in the bylaws that we could use, and so one of which is an expert tax task force, or maybe we call it a task force only. So I think as a community, we need to explore that, and obviously everyone needs a voice and needs to be heard, but, we don't have 10 years to discuss this. We have a short deadline to figure this out and do it right. And we have the people to do it. I think the community is. Steve Metallitz, please.
Thank you. Steve Metallitz speaking. Susan, thank you for bringing up the UWG report. This is an incredibly important resource that we can rely on. Again, not for the final answer, but for a great starting point. And as I recall, at the time the EWG report was released, there was some discussion about sending this to the Article 29 Working Party or to DPAs and asking for their feedback on it. And one issue we were, the IPC, we were very interested in was their reaction, and did they think this would help address the data protection issues that they were raising. Do we know if that was ever done, and did any of the DPAs or the Article 29 Working Party, maybe we can pose this to the earlier panel from the EDPS and from the Commission, do we know if they've ever looked at this, at the EWG report, maybe specifically at this aspect of it that you've highlighted here? Because I think, again, that could put us ahead of the game if they've already, they've had this report available for 3 or 4 years, and hopefully they've come to some views on it.
So the only thing, there has been some calls for ICANN to submit this to the data authorities in Europe. In the Aptitex model, which I worked on with Faisal Shah, that was one in our opening statement, was please send the EWG report over and please let's get a viewpoint on this, because there's a lot of good work in this report. If you've noted especially the EC technical input document, they do reference the EWG report on accuracy. So I would assume that some of them have seen it and read parts of it. But no, I don't think. And, in the Aptitex request, there was no response from ICANN on that. Recently on the RDS working group, which you may have seen that, Rod Rasmussen also suggested the same thing. Let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's look at this and get an evaluation. But, has that happened? Not as far as I know.
Hi, Ashley Heineman from NTIA, but also the U.S. GAC representative. Just wanted to make you aware, if you're not already, the GAC did have a conversation with ICANN yesterday in terms of socializing their interim plan. And there was a specific task to the GAC, which was basically, one, to provide a listing of all law enforcement and government users anticipated for who is, as well as to develop a code of conduct for all other users. And GAC input asked to, as soon as possible. We're not sure what all this means yet. We haven't had a chance as a GAC to kind of come together and talk about it. But it's certainly a lot for the GAC to do. And I suspect at a very minimum that we will have to talk to other users outside of government in terms of what your needs are, what your thoughts are. So I just wanted to lay that down in case you weren't aware, because I imagine it's going to make us either very popular or unpopular moving forward.
Good to know. Thank you. And we should all work together on this.
Hi, Susan. This is Catherine.
Hey, Catherine, go ahead.
Sorry, I disconnected us earlier when I hit the wrong button instead of the unmute us button. But just to respond to the question about whether the EWG report was shared with the Article 29, whether they weighed in, I believe it was not. But on the EWG, there was also a representative of the European Commission, and I remember that at the time, both we for DG Home and the colleagues from DG Justice provided input that the colleague, Michael Niebuhr, then conveyed to the EWG to ensure that the proposals in the report were also compliant with the then Data Protection Directive. So there were some efforts done on this, and I believe this is also reflected in the report, which is why we also refer to it in the union position. So there's some, I would just also second what Susan was saying, that there's some really excellent efforts in the report that are worthy of further exploration now.
Thank you, Catherine, for reminding me. Michael actually, you know, was a great leader in the EWG and provided a lot of input, and we appreciated his work. Thanks all.
Great. Thank you so much. That was a really great discussion. I want to thank Susan and Alex. I want to thank everyone for all their questions. We have, in a couple minutes, John Jeffries and Akhtar Mukhtala joining us to talk a little bit more about the convergence model and to answer our questions. I propose maybe we take a 2 or 3 minute break and give our guests a chance to arrive, and then we can restart.
We'll start again in 1 minute. We'll be joined by Akram Adala, John Jeffrey, and Teresa Swinehart. All right, thanks, everyone. Steve Del Bianco here with the BC. We're going to pick up again on our agenda. And this is a discussion of ICANN's convergence model. I think everyone will want to tune in and pay attention to this since it's coming directly from ICANN's head of the Global Domains Division, Akram Adala. It's coming also from John Jeffrey, General Counsel of ICANN, and Teresa Swinehart in ICANN Management as well. So Akram and JJ, my understanding is you're together in a place. So we're going to turn it over to you. We can go as much as 45 minutes, perhaps 5 minutes longer, since I know there will be a lot of questions, and we'll watch that in Adobe. So Akram and JJ, the floor is yours.
Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for having us on the call. And there is a beeping sound. Can we get rid of that? Can you hear me?
Hi, Akram. This is Yvette. I'm working on that. My apologies.
No problem.
Akram, if you can endure the high-pitched whine in the ears, we can still understand you. So please proceed while Yvette works this out.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks again for having us here. We have a lot of staff also listening to this call. We wanted to actually take the time to answer any clarifying questions on the model that we are converging towards, and also hear from you your concerns and what transpired yesterday during your discussions with the contracted parties, and if there are any outcomes from that, would be really appreciated if we could hear that from you as well. John, anything to add?
No, not at this time.
Very good. So we'll start just by giving a little bit of history how we got here, and then we will go through the model, and we'll try to do it quickly so that we leave enough time for Q&A. You know, we set out early on to build a record, a public record of the purpose of the who is, so that we can have a legitimate purpose for the collection, for the storage, and for transfer and display of the who is record. We collected that from the community, and we built that record. We put out three different models for the community to comment on. And the three models were taking the three different extremes, one that is as close to the current who is with a little bit of compliance with the GDPR, to the other side, which is extreme compliance with the GDPR and going away from the model, and then a model that's in between the two, trying to thread the needle between the two, you know, staying as true as possible to the consensus policy, as well as providing compliance with GDPR. We collected all the information from the community and all the comments, as well as other models that were suggested by the community. And then now we're still collecting information, and we're coalescing into a model that is oh, great. Thank you. That was painful. So we're coalescing with a model that is a more of a collection of all of the input that we got There are still now some areas of debate that we are trying to focus on, and we will go through the model. John will walk us through the model and give us the headlights, and then we could actually go back to answer questions. But the important thing is that we've been communicating with the DPAs, we've been engaging with the community, European community, as well as the global community, to try to explain what the WHO is and how it works, and also why we use it and how it is in the public interest to continue to have the WHO is being public. And I think we've done a good job so far, and we have a communication with the DPAs coming up as well to explain to them this model that we're converging on and see where we go from there. So with that, I'll give it to John.
Very good. And Steve, please tell me if the right thing to do is to go through our proposed interim model at this point. I know you all have been engaged in discussions yesterday. We don't have the results of that yet and know where you've agreed. So some of these things obviously may be adjusting depending on the outcome of those discussions. Is it your preference that I just go through the proposed interim model that we were talking about before your discussions yesterday? Is there anyone still there?
Did we lose everybody?
Maybe the tone went away because no one's there.
Hi, everyone. This is Yvette, the host in the room. I can hear you loud and clear. So let me see if we can. At least we lost the tone. We got part A going. So let me see if we can get everybody's sound back. Part B. My apologies, guys. Working on that.
Akram and John, can you hear this?
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. John, before you proceed, Akram, while you described a process that was indeed community public, there have been, over the past 2 weeks, very narrowly focused discussions with the contract parties on your convergence model, and I believe with a couple of leaders of the IPC. But to my knowledge, no other members of the ICANN community were dialed up for a discussion, a walkthrough of the convergence model. So I don't think it would be strictly accurate to say that it's been circulated to all, the convergence discussions, and this was noted in the Adobe chat. I just note that to suggest that as JJ moves to a discussion of the convergence model, it will be the first time that most people on this webinar will have heard anything about it. So JJ, what would be so helpful is to walk through, and on each point, we will take questions in Adobe, and please help us understand if you have moved from the ICANN 3 community models, and convergence represents something different. It will help us so much to understand what information or comment or legal analysis you relied upon to tweak what we first saw in early January on the 3 ICANN models and the convergence model you're describing today. So with that, JJ, over to you.
Hi, Steve. Just to answer your original question, it's very difficult for us to actually do this globally with everybody and still the work done in such a short period of time. We tried to reach out to as many people as we could to bounce off some of the concepts. And let's remember that this is not a final model. This is a model that we're going to be discussing now and in the future, even after we post it, to see what the feedback is, and then we're going to collect as much feedback as we get and then come up with the final. So this is a draft model for now. With that, I'll give it to JJ.
Yeah, and just to further elaborate, so it's a draft model, and the reason we hadn't gone to publication is because we understand it's a draft or a proposal, not a formal document, and not something that we were ready to come out with without engaging further with the contracted parties, with anyone that's willing to talk about it. And we were well aware of the meeting being scheduled yesterday and had been asked by various leaders to not publish our model until that discussion occurred and there was an opportunity to adjust elements of it. But I'm happy to go through what we had put on the table, like a straw proposal, as a proposed interim convergence model that could be used for compliance and could be used as a discussion point for both these types of discussions as well as for discussions with the DPAs if they were prepared to speak to us. We haven't spoken to the DPAs about this model, in part because they wanted to hear what the community output was and make sure that we were incorporating that into this model before we brought it to them. So I understand the tone and your frustration, but I hope that you understand we're just trying to work through a process and hope that you will help us and understand whether this is a good approach or whether there are elements of it that still need to be improved. So with that, I don't know what's going to be up in this on the screen or if you have anything that you can put up, but if for those of you who are familiar with the document that we published earlier, which was the non-paper, which set out a number of different proposals and gridded them against each other so that you could see how those various elements worked. If you're looking at that paper, you can follow along on that. If not, listen and please interject with any questions. We've broken the models down for understanding the comparatives into a number of different categories. The first category being data collection, processing, and retention. The second being how it would be applied, applicability. The third being what would appear in the public who is. And then the fourth being what would appear in non-public who is. So how would non-public who is be approached? And so I'll start with the data collection and processing and retention. And so what I'm going to refer to very specifically now is our straw proposal, our interim proposal that we're hoping to put on the table to talk about. So for looking at collection from registrant to registrar, we've looked deeply at the full set of data that is being collected now, the full set of thick data that is collected by some of the registrars for registries. And we looked at various fields to determine, are there individual fields that were being underutilized or that were not being utilized at all? And we identified a field that we couldn't see in the public who is was being utilized. We now understand there's some different input coming back on that and that there is a purpose for its use in the anti-abuse community. And so the registry registrant ID was a field we saw that wasn't being utilized, but we understand that now may be utilized. We also understand there's been additional community dialogue about whether various fields are useful and important to collect. And so we're interested in input back from the community on that particular topic. On data transfer from registrar to registry and on data transfer to escrow agents, we see both of those being a full transfer of data that is collected. So if the field is somehow limited by those that are underutilized or not useful, then it would be that data set. If it's the full data set, then that would be the data set that's transferred. On data retention, as you're all aware, there's been a discussion in the community about can require retention of the data. In the ECHO model, for example, it had proposed eliminating ICANN data retention requirements. In the IPC model, it said life of registration plus 2 years. In looking across these models and the purpose of retention and looking at the conversations that had occurred on the RIA, with registrars and different DPAs relating to who is information in the past, we selected as part of our straw model life of registration plus 2 years, noting those existing waivers of registrars that had already been preserved. I'll move forward then to applicability. So the question is, must the model be applied globally or only to the European Economic Area? And when we looked across the various models that had been presented from the community and read the community dialogue, there was a divergence in this approach as well. Some, like the ECHO model and a handful of others, suggested a global approach. And the IPC, the GAC, and other models applied, said it would be applied only to the European Economic Area registrants. We tried to take a middle approach to this, looking at the difficulty of determining in many cases who would be a European registrant as opposed to a global registrant. Also wanting to take into account the fact that there may be businesses, contracted parties who may have unique business models and only serve non-European registrants. So we believe that obviously the model must be applied to the EEA for European registrants, but that we would allow for a global approach for those contracted parties who believe that it was too difficult to differentiate between the two. And where there would be an election, as an example, we think this is a starting point for where it would be useful to have a controller agreement in place between the contracted parties and ICANN about how those selections could be made and how choices like applying or not applying the model would be specified. Moving to the row registrant types affected, here there was a divergence in the models between registrations of natural and legal persons or just natural persons only. And looking across that data, we believe that the registration of natural and legal persons was useful in part because of the use of personally identifiable information sometimes in the legal person's data. Moving on to what would be presented in the public quiz, continue to be presented in the public quiz, and we understand this is still part of what is controversial in our proposal and still in discussion. I'll just run through this quickly. Registrant name in public quiz, we think that the registrant organization, if it's applicable, could and should be published in the public quiz, but perhaps not the specific registrant name if it is PII. On registrant postal address in the public quiz, we believe that there has to be information provided to identify the jurisdiction where the registrant is, for example, state, province, and country, but perhaps not the street, city, and postal code information, which would be considered more directed PII. On registrant email in the public quiz, we saw a solution emerging from some of the various models. The Coalition for Online Accountability model and the ECHO model both had a suggestion of creating anonymized email or a web form to contact the registrant. So we proposed that as a possible solution. And we're asking participants in yesterday's meeting to consider whether that was a useful approach. On registrant phone and fax and admin and tech contact names, we were saying that did not be put into the public quiz. On admin and tech contact postal addresses, we were also saying it would not be part of the public quiz. On admin tech contact email addresses, we believe that this could also be approached through the anonymized email or web form as opposed to publishing the exact identifying information. On admin tech contact phone in public quiz, we believe that could be left out of the public quiz. And on the registrar's opportunity to provide opt-in for publication of additional data to the registrant, we believe that that's an important element as well as we looked across those fields. Now, going back through just what's going to be presented in the public quiz, an important element of thinking about this is that is the information that will be publicly displayed, but not just the information that would be available if an accredited party were to obtain access to what is not public. So these information fields would all be collected still, but they would not be presented in the public quiz, would only be available to those who had some form of approval to gain access to what is behind the firewall or in the non-public quiz.
John, before you jump to the – John, this is Steve. Before you jump to the non-public – okay.
Yeah, I'm almost finished. It might be useful to just let me go through the last couple of fields, and then we could go to questions if that's okay, Steve.
Yeah, JJ, this is Steve. The distinction about what made the cut between public and non-public could enjoy 10 minutes of Q&A, and then the non-public information and the access methods could deserve another segment. So perhaps withhold the non-public and certification discussion and allow to take a few questions, if you would, on what made the cut between public and non-public.
Yeah, if you don't mind, though, let me explain the last part because I think it grounds why we're looking at this the way that we were looking at it in the model. So we think self-certification access presents an issue. If we're allowing the choice to go to every registrar and registry about whether they self-certify, if there's some other method of self-certification, it could be considered. But we think also the creation of the anonymized email address and the web form to be able to contact the registrants and to be able to contact the tech and admin contacts presented an opportunity to provide information directly to those parties, perhaps even instantaneously, the same way you would in emailing them. And then the last part on accreditation program for access to non-public WHOIS, we think this is a really important part of considering this. Without this part, this would certainly change the approach we have to the rest of the model. We think that it's very important that there be an accreditation program, and then that be done in consultation with the GAC, that we allow for individual countries to provide the GAC a list of authorized law enforcement authorities that would have access, and that the GAC could work with us and the community to develop a code of conduct for non-law enforcement agencies to abide by for access to the non-public WHOIS data, and that there could be an opportunity for a centralized accreditation point which would allow registrars and registries to know very, very quickly whether or not parties that are accredited, for example, many of the parties in the room that have legitimate reasons to want to access the non-public WHOIS information, if they are accredited, they would have instantaneous access to that non-public WHOIS database. And with that, I'll pause, and we can take any questions.
JJ, thank you. This is Steve. We'll try a 10-minute question segment on what made the cut and what didn't, and then move on to the accreditation certification process for the non-public. JJ, you noted that, and I understand now why you wanted to proceed with the conclusion of your presentation, because you believe that with the addition of an anonymized relay address, that the four elements that would be in the public WHOIS would be sufficient, you believe, for most purposes. And just to repeat, it was the registrant's organization, the registrant's state and province, and the registrant's country, plus an anonymized email address that could be used to relay to the registrant. Do I have that right?
That's correct. Well, relay, or you might know more technically than I would as the lawyer, maybe I should give it to Akram. But as I understand it, if the approach were anonymized email, I think there's other potential proposals that are coming up, for example, hashtagged information or information that might be allow you to connect different registrants or admin and tech contacts across data fields or across registration types. Then I think, but if I go back to anonymized email, the concept would be that you'd get a same way you might look at I can't think of a service now that's doing it, but there's a couple of services we had referenced. eBay might be one. Craigslist might be another, where instead of displaying the actual email address, it provides you with a clear email address that is unique to the individual registrant or admin or tech contact, and that if you put that email address in your browser, it would be relayed, I believe, through the server directly to that party in, you know, a matter of less than a second. But that's the idea, that it would be, without showing you the exact address, you could get the email directly to the registrant, admin contact, or tech contact. And I don't pretend to have this as a full answer. This is one of the things that we've been saying to everyone we talk to. If you have a better way of approaching this, a different approach to this, we're very interested in it, and we don't represent that this is the end-all.
JJ, this is Steve. Thank you for acknowledging a need, which was identified in our gap analysis, the need for correlated or reverse WHOIS lookups, and I think you just articulated that you've acknowledged that need in the sense that this anonymized email contact would be globally unique to each registrant. And that would at least create the opportunity for a reverse whois lookup to identify other registrations held by that same registrant, even though that registrant's PII isn't displayed in the public whois. So is that your appreciation of the goal?
I want to be crisp. This is not my acknowledgement of the need or a decision by me. This is my reference to what we had heard in some of the initial discussions and an understanding that that's the request. So I'm not an authority and, you know, have the authority to change the position. I think what we're asking you to do is provide us with that information that justifies that, and hopefully in your discussions yesterday that was part of the discussion.
Well, thank you. Yes, the acknowledgement that the community has requested it is important, but the notion of concepts of having it be a globally unique anonymized information at least holds the potential for satisfying some more of the needs that are there. JJ, we're going to take a quick cue on questions for the next several minutes on the public versus non-public cut. Steve Metallitz here in the DC room will have the mic.
Yes, this is Steve Metallitz. You have several questions in the Adobe about this as well. You may not see that. But on the registrant email, JJ, you said you have not reviewed this convergence model with the DPAs, and I'm sure you know that that most of the feedback you received from the community, at least numerically, was stressed the importance of preserving the public access to registrant email that exists today. And you've often said also that the goal, ICANN's goal, is to maintain as much as possible of the existing whois system while achieving compliance with the GDPR. So is it safe to assume that you have concluded that including registrant email in the public whois, which so many people rely upon today, have you concluded that that would violate the GDPR? And if so, since you have not reviewed this with the Article 29 Working Party, what is your basis for that conclusion?
No, and in fact, as you're probably aware, because I think we received an email from you shortly after the discussion when we spoke with the IPC community leaders, there was a suggestion that there might be additional information to show us that it would be consistent with the GDPR to publish that, and we asked for additional information to be provided to us. We've heard differing legal opinions on that point and are very interested in additional information. So there's no conclusion. As I said at the beginning, what we were trying to look at is across all of these data fields, knowing that we would get some things wrong and that this needed to be adjusted, we wanted to put this out as the proposed interim model as a discussion point so that you could provide this sort of input that would allow us to make sure that we had the community input in before we got to a point where we're publishing it and before we got to the point where we're discussing it with DPAs. We are concerned, though, that there is a belief that we're going to present a model to the DPAs and we're going to get their blessing, and we don't believe that that's the case. We believe we'll have to have a strong set of indicia supporting each of the positions that we take across the model. And one of the things that we're creating right now is what we're calling the cookbook, which is literally looking at each of these issues and going into detail about that to provide the justifications for the various positions that will be taken in that model. So no conclusion yet. We're listening. Please provide us with the additional information that you're referring to that you say tells us that it's not illegal to publish that information. And that's the kind of information we need in order to put a field into the cookbook.
Thank you, JJ. We next have Brian Winterfeld and then Laureen. Here, Brian.
Thank you again for joining us. Brian Winterfeld, IPC President. I believe you might have referenced this earlier, but since we're sort of going through which data elements are going to be public versus non-public, I wanted to remind everyone that the IPC had put forward that the registrant city is something that should and we believe, well, could and we believe should be included in the public portion. And I believe also
Zip code is something else that may be able to be included, at least in part, and we'll definitely follow up with you with more feedback on that, but I wanted to put that forward.
Thank you, Brian. Laureen Capon.
Hi, JJ and Akram, and I had the benefit yesterday of also hearing your discussion participating with the GAC, and I actually wanted to follow up on one of the issues that was raised during yesterday's call. And my concern here is that the convergence model appears to go beyond what the GDPR itself requires. It does that in terms of the territoriality and the distinction between natural and legal entities, i.e. the GDPR protects personal information, and that's what a lot of its protections are aimed at. But the convergence model prevents even information relating to legal entities from being disclosed. And we had pressed a little bit on that issue, and Akram, you had, I think, responded to the question of why aren't you making the distinction in the convergence model in terms of the publication of information relating to legal entities, for example, an email for belonging to a legal entity. And I think your response, and please jump in if I've gotten it wrong, was that practically speaking, logistically speaking, it's difficult to distinguish from looking at the who is data fields between a legal entity and a natural entity. And my question is, with that long buildup, my question is, couldn't there be a practical way to actually just have a registrant identify by checking a box, I'm a natural person, or checking the other box, I'm a legal person? And separate and apart from the fact that maybe some people will lie about that, wouldn't that be a very easy, simple way to actually resolve that issue and then not have a model that essentially over-complies with the GDPR and instead provides more useful information to the community that relies on such information to perform many of its public safety functions?
Go ahead, JJ.
This is Akram. Thank you for the question, and you know, this is what we're trying to do. Is we're trying to collect all the information that we can get and on this model and try to balance everything we hear. Again, I don't think the idea is for looking at the email address, but the idea is that something automated that would actually work. Because otherwise, who is will not work if everybody has to eyeball every request and every record. And the other concerns that we have is, you know, how do you deal with the 150, 160 million records that are already there? So there are a lot of issues, and we're trying to make the implementation feasible in as quickly as possible of whatever model we go to. I appreciate your concerns about not separating the natural from the legal, and we will take that into consideration and we'll look at it.
And I think just to reiterate the earlier point that we made when Steve's question came up, that we are still very interested in, you referenced a specific number of things that you believe make the use and publication of that information public, and providing us with background support for that, precisely referencing how that would be compliant with GDPR would be very useful to us as we're building the cookbook and considering that.
Thank you, JJ. We're going to cut the queue with the two questions that were raised earlier on the question of what's in the public who is versus private, and then move on to questions that are specifically targeted to the accreditation or certification. So, Marilyn, I will ask you to ask your question briefly, and then Alexander, ask your question, and then we'll turn to JJ for his answers. Thank you. Cannot hear you, Marilyn. All right, let's skip Marilyn and go to Alexander, please.
Yes, sorry, this is Catherine. I'm abusing Alexander's presence in the chat room to raise my hand. Hi, Akram and JJ. Thank you so much for joining. This is Catherine from the European Commission. And I just want to build on what Steve Metalitz was saying earlier about the rationale for including or not including registered name and email address in the publicly available WHOIS. And I would suggest that, with all due respect, that in the cookbook, you sort of perform a step that is missing here, which is to check what purposes you would be doing this for. So it's very difficult on the basis of just general use cases or the need perceived in some part of the community to assess whether this could be publicly available or not. And I think there are a ton of use cases that have already been collected, a lot of evidence in the context of the expert working group report of the present-day RDS-PDP, and also use cases collected this summer as part of this task force that ICANN ran for a brief moment that could allow you to identify the purposes and then see whether on that basis you cannot identify a legal basis in the GDPR for the public availability. And that's what is sort of missing here, and that would be the missing element also that would be, as a DPA, the first thing I would ask you, why or why not would you be making this? So just a suggestion here, not really expecting an answer. And we're, of course, happy again to support you in this endeavor.
Yes, so thank you very much for the question or statement. I think there's some interesting elements to what you're saying, so I do want to reply to it. You're in a much more unique position than we are in this, in that you're affiliated with the law, the people who are setting the law, and the people who will enforce the law. We're struggling with the existence of that law and trying to figure out how to make sure that we in our industry sector are compliant with it. So obviously the work that we've done, you know, starting last summer and coming through the fall and collecting information about how the different fields are used by different elements of the community, the work that's been done in setting forth the various legal opinions, the external legal opinions, and talking about what we believe is, you know, we took external advice that in some cases we weren't even 100% connected to. And consistent with, and then we heard other legal advice from other people on those same elements that you're talking about what is legal and what is not. And so the cookbook is intended to be the culmination of that, to look at how we can justify the positions that we're choosing to take in that compliance model, and to be able to defend ICANN's position as well as the community's position and the contracted party's positions in publishing or not publishing that information while still trying to maintain the value and purposes of the historical WHOIS that outdates ICANN. So anything that you could do to formalize an official position based on what you're saying, to say that if you know the answers to the questions, if you have access to people who know the answers to the questions and can provide us guidance that would help us, and you could put that in writing to us as a position from your organization, that would be very valuable to us, and it would be something that would stop our guessing and speculating and help us understand how to move forward with a compliance model that's actually useful and valuable to our community and to ICANN.
JJ, this is Steve. Earlier on the call, we pressed Catherine and Christian from DPA staff on that very question, and their fair comeback to us was that we would need to present things that are specific in order to even have any expectation of a specific response from DPAs. Catherine, a question follow-up for you is, if in fact we dusted off a long list of legitimate use cases for the registrant name and email address to be public, would that be sufficient to have it become public, or is there a concern that there might be counter use cases where someone does things with their registrant name and email that do not serve a purpose or go against public purposes? In other words, what is your analysis? Is it the overwhelming quantity of legitimate use cases, or is the presence of any illegitimate use going to be defeating what we're after?
Right, Steve, this is Catherine. So I guess that's the million-dollar question. And again, you know, I want to clarify once more, because I think JJ and Akram were not around. The Commission as such is not the regulator. Of course, we're happy to facilitate conversations with the regulators, the national DPAs, and we've done so, and I understand ICANN is engaging with them. That being said, I think, Steve, the use cases are a really good place to start, because what we would need to do is we definitely have to distill legitimate purposes from these use cases and then see whether, in view of the unlegitimized uses of the WHOIS for things such as spamming and other abuse, whether the public display is proportionate or not, and if there are other means that would achieve the same aim with while excluding the unlegitimate use cases. So, for example, if you have a self-certification mechanism that allows also your normal user or somebody who is not accredited by some organization to occasionally have access to the WHOIS, then that could be another way of achieving that proportionality while preserving the usefulness. So I come back to my earlier statement that the devil sort of lies in the details. The best thing would be to set out a number of different options and then to see what really would be most useful for the community and also most proportionate from the GDPR perspective. And there the use cases in both directions are an excellent starting point.
Thanks so much, Catherine.
Could I interject with a comment or a question?
Of course, please go ahead.
Catherine, what you just said is exactly the sort of information that would benefit us to have in writing that would be useful. So thank you for making the statement. And then just a question back to Steve. You mentioned there was DPA staff in the room and that you were questioning them earlier. Could you clarify who that is and what their relationship is to the DPAs?
Thank you, JJ. We were fortunate to have Christian Dukuna, who was on the phone. He is a staff to a DPA, who's part of the Article 29 working group.
And JJ, sorry, this is Catherine. We did put that in writing on page 3 of the Commission comments on the technical modules, which were submitted on February 7th. And we're, of course, happy to elaborate on those anytime that would be useful. Thank you.
Great. I think we're going to go ahead and please go ahead, Catherine.
I was just Claudia just reminded me it might be good to tell you that Christian has left, so he can no longer react. He had to go to another appointment.
Thank you so much. I think we're going to shift the focus.
So our question was about Christian. My understanding is he's not DPA staff. Can someone check that fact?
He's EDPS staff.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So we're going to shift our conversation now from the data that is included and not included. Definitely from what's in the convergence model right now, there is very little that is included that will be public-facing, which really brings us to the question of gated access and what model we're going to be looking at for credentialing or accreditation. If the reality is potentially that very little to almost no information is going to be available publicly. My first question is, what is your vision for once someone is credentialed or is granted access, what level of access do you anticipate they would have and what duration of time would you envision that being for?
Yeah, so we've only considered two tiers. So it would be either you're accessing the public WHOIS, or you're able to access, with the accreditation, the full set of data.
That's super helpful, and that does line up with our prior conversations. I wanted to outline that we've had conversations with the contracted parties where they put a very different vision forward, where they envisioned incredibly limited access, potentially having to do additional verifications upon every single query to the database and having your queries be potentially limited domain by domain. So that is a bit of a disconnect that we wanted to point out. Obviously, again, if very little is going to be public, what the certification or credentialing process looks like and the kind of access that's granted becomes paramount in order for us to function and do our jobs to protect consumers and protect IP assets and for law enforcement and security folks to do their jobs. So I wanted to just put that forward.
Yeah, so I want to confirm we've had no discussions that I'm aware of outside of the two tiers.
We are going to take a brief cue because we are running up against the end of the hour. We'll take a brief cue on the questions only pertaining to the gated access, please. So I see Marilyn Cade and Lori Schulman each ask the question, and then JJ will reply. Marilyn, do not hear you. We'll move on to Lori Schulman.
Hello. Am I being heard? Am I being heard?
Yes.
Okay. I'm speeding it up. JJ, thank you, and Akram. I just have a question about wording that's confusing me. So I see in paragraph 2 it says, otherwise an accreditation program is necessary to facilitate access to non-public data. And then in paragraph 4 I see ICANN is also exploring other accreditation mechanisms for non-law enforcement access. So I'm kind of trying to figure out, has ICANN committed to providing accreditation mechanisms for non-law enforcement access, if that's the case, that you're committed in exploring what will work? I think that's different than just saying exploring, because that doesn't, to me, sound like a commitment.
Go ahead, JJ.
You have an advantage over us in that we don't know what document you're referring to. So you said in paragraph 2 and paragraph 4?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the overview of ICANN convergence model, and then on one side it says category. Do you have that? Okay. Well, take a look at this slide, because I do think whatever wording, no, seriously, I think the wording is important to understand if ICANN will actually commit to an accreditation process.
Yes, I think one of the challenges is because the model that we're speaking about has not been officially published. Lori is looking at the slides that we put together that summarize the model. So I think, you know, obviously, I think
so
instead of updating the actual wording,
yeah, thank you. So if I understand the question, then let me just restate it. So are we committed to an accreditation model or process? Is that the question, or is there a different question?
That is exact. Yes, that's exactly the question.
Yeah, as I said, when we went to that last section in explaining what our model is, we think that accreditation model is critical to the approach that we're taking in our model. Without that, that means that there would be a significant part of the WHOIS that would not be accessible to parties that we understand have an important value in obtaining that information.
Thank you, JJ. The last two questions are Fabricio Vieira and James Bladel. They will each ask a question in the room, and then you can reply. Fabricio.
Thank you. Hey, JJ, it's Fabricio from Perkins Coie. I had a quick question about credentialing and accreditation generally. Do you envision that anyone who is credentialed or, you know, goes through an accreditation process would then have to go through additional layers, registrar or registry individually? Another way to put it, do you envision that the credentialing process allows for registries and registrars to then add their own layers of different terms and conditions, different check boxes, different basically gating?
Yeah, so we're trying to stay as close to the community's viewpoints and the value of the WHOIS as possible. So we understand there's going to be a policy process that will follow from this. We apply what we were given in terms of what the WHOIS policy, small p, if you were, is. And we've tried through the use of our approach to this model and through the whole thing to stay as close to that as possible, recognizing that there's now a law that is impacting our ability to maintain the former WHOIS, the current WHOIS, in all of its parts. So that's the answer, I think, in part. And then if I understood your question, you were going beyond that.
I think what Fabricio was asking is, will there be a differentiation that the registrars and registries can do in the WHOIS?
So the question we had before, is there contemplation of a registry or registrar level approval beyond the accreditation? And we had not heard that as a proposal from the community. You're introducing that topic to us for the first time, and I understand that's from your discussions yesterday. we've only talked about two layers, and our belief is that if there's an accreditation program coming into this discussion, our belief is if there's an accreditation program, that would provide you with all access to what isn't published, so the full set of data fields, and that there that would be something that you could readily do. With that accreditation, you would be able to access that non-public WHOIS data. So that's the approach we've taken all through, and we've had no other discussion about that up until this point.
Great. Thank you, JJ.
Thank you. James Bladel.
Where are we?
It's on.
We can't hear James.
Any of these working? How's this? This good? This one. How about this? Okay, thanks.
Yeah, we can hear you.
There's too many microphones. Okay, thanks, JJ. Not a question for JJ and Akram, but I just want to back up to something that Brian asked or stated at the beginning of this section. Part of our discussions yesterday, I think we've been, as contracted parties, we're fairly consistent that we don't know how we would operationalize a check of credentials for every single domain name lookup. We don't want that approach. That's cumbersome and clumsy. We'd like to find something in between that and, kind of the all-you-can-eat approach to private gated WHOIS data. So I think somewhere in between, whether it's a per account or some credentials that are valid for a certain period of time and then expire, all of those I think are potentially up for discussion. But the checking of the credentials per each lookup, I think we agree, is unworkable.
Great, James. Thank you so much. It's super helpful clarification. I still think it's helpful for JJ and Akram to hear because it's still a little bit different, I think, than what they're envisioning. So I think that's helpful for them to be aware of that. I wanted to maybe ask or point out a couple big issues because I think we're almost out of time. One of the issues I know is that we, in our talks with contracted parties, we know that a lot of them are already coding. We know a lot of them are going to be doing their own analysis of the ICANN model when it rolls out. What is ICANN going to do if they roll out their interim model and it's not actually adopted by the registries and registrars, or at least many of them decide to adopt their own models?
Sorry, we missed part of your question. Do you mind restating it? Sorry, Brian.
No problem. In our discussions with contracted parties over the past several weeks, we've learned that they have a lot of technical challenges in terms of actually implementing changes to their platforms, which we can all understand, and that in many cases, things typically would require months and months and months of pre-planning and coding in order to actually implement. So many of them are actually coding as we speak. Their kind of first launch of what their first stab at being compliant is going to be. And obviously, we're still talking about what a model is going to look like, and for good reason. We're still having community discussions. I think we all agree we wish we were having these discussions a year ago, but here we are. My question is, if ICANN rolls out an interim model and registries and registrars decide because of their own legal advice they're receiving internally or issues specific to their company that they're not going to comply with that model, what is ICANN's approach going to be to that?
Yes, yeah, so we're going to need help here. Our goal is to not have registrars or registries go black, meaning hide the information that's in WHOIS on the date that it goes into effect. So we're seeking to provide a model that is approachable, that is capable of being rolled out. And if the model that we have to go to is a model that can't be rolled out, then we will be asking for help from the DPAs and from others to allow that model to roll out in a timeline that would be that would let that happen in a feasible way, and seeking some element of having that not be forced into a compliance mechanism where we would have penalties coming to ICANN or to the contracted parties. Now, this is the great problem as we're coming into the final stages of this, and it's going to require the community to come together on what the model is, and then jointly to be approaching the authorities to ask for forbearance if that's required, or for the community to come together on solutions that are actually workable and capable of being implemented. So I think this is, you know, our collective problem as we head into these final months.
Great. Thank you so much. Since we are out of time, I did just want to drop in a couple issues that we would love to continue talking with you about and that we plan hopefully following up with you in writing. One of them is bulk who is access and what the future of that looks like and how important that is for a lot of the work that's done for security and stability on the Internet. Also, data accuracy is an area that we would love to explore more. There are requirements in the EU that data actually be accurate, and so our question is how that actually applies to the DNS and registries and registrars, and that's something we'll be looking forward to talking to you more about and hopefully providing feedback and input from our perspective as well.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you all for giving us the opportunity to address your questions, and we look forward to continue our communications and our discussions, and hopefully we can close on this as soon as possible so we can address some of the concerns that were outlined here. So,
and just one question, how was there a contemplated approach to providing us where there was convergence yesterday among your groups, and how would, can we look to seeing that, and what's sort of the next steps from your side in terms of providing us with information?
Sure. So I think everyone's not even aware there was a very small group that came together of volunteers. It was something that was organized and led by the IPC. We invited a few key other participants from the BC to participate as well, and then we had some folks from the Contracted Party House, and the idea was to get together to talk about the convergence model and look for areas of agreement, common ground, hopefully come to some solutions. Our goal from that is to hopefully come to you with a communication that will confirm for you where there's areas of agreement and hopefully push some areas forward. We are going to work, I think, on some kind of written communication to you and hopefully get that to you fairly quickly. In addition, I think the IPC and BC plan on following up today's event with a written communication to you that outlines our analysis more deeply on the gap-filling efforts that we think need to be done on the convergence model, both in terms of changes we think need to be seen to the elements that are present, as well as holes that we think need to be filled for areas that are not contemplated in the model that's been reviewed with us. So our hope is to get lots of feedback to you in the next day or so.
JJ, this is Steve. For you and Akram, when we conclude this session, I'll write to the business constituency members about key takeaways. And I took two major takeaways from your presentation. The first is that the publication of the interim model is not really the interim model. It's a draft that will be published that will be then further used to solicit input from community members as well as authorities in Europe. And that is a little different than what we had expected, but I'm happy to go with that. The second is that you talk about it as convergence, but to converge, one tries to find common ground among parties with different views. I think you've acknowledged that perhaps there's a subset of decisions that will represent convergence, but many of the decisions will not be a convergence at all. There'll be some sort of a middle ground, I think this is the word JJ used, a middle ground between divergent points of view. And that middle ground doesn't represent convergence as much as it does a forced compromise between irreconcilable positions. So it will be vital to do what Brian said and for us to provide the kind of evidence that we need to help steer where that point arrives, but as well to recognize that you should identify where you think you found convergence, since that'll be the easy stuff. And the harder stuff is where you note a wide divergence and have instead decided to place a compromise or middle ground solution out there for discussion next week. If you have any reaction to that, please do, before we thank the helpers for this session and conclude.
Thank you, Steve, for the last comment, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to all of you. There's a couple of important points. One, we'd prefer that there was a community policy that was adopted and that there's no question. We don't have that, unfortunately. So we're now faced with compliance with a law and trying to guide contracted parties through our agreements in some manner to a place where, as a controller, as a co-controller, at least, of the information, we're put in a position where ICANN is potentially at risk for the decisions that we have to make out of this. So I completely agree. There are going to be points where we're picking between difficult positions at the end of this, and hopefully we're doing that based on the best input that all of you are providing and an understanding of the position that we're faced with by a law we didn't create, and we're still having some ambiguity around and trying to understand. So thank you for your patience, and we appreciate all of the information that you're providing and the hard questions, because I think this is how we get to a point where we're, you know, I hadn't used the term convergence model, but I kind of like it, because what we're trying to do is really get to a point where the community has given all the input and we're picking the best possible solution for all of us. Thanks.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I really want to thank Akram and JJ and Teresa for joining us today and for giving us so much time. I want to thank all of our speakers for joining us today. I want to thank ICANN staff, including Yvette, who did a fantastic job supporting us around the globe. I believe we had, at one point, over 170 participants online alone, in addition to the folks in person in Brussels and D.C. I want to thank ICANN for supplying us the office in Brussels. Again, this is just a continuation, and we want the dialogue to continue going, and please continue to give Steve or I or anyone in the IPC or BC feedback on next steps and any ideas you have so we can keep the conversation and dialogue going. And thank you, everyone, and I wish you a good rest of your day.
Thanks. Bye, all.
Bye.